All right, guys. So welcome to the FPL Dialogue. I'm your host, Javed Khan at FPL Dagger FC. My co-host for today is Lima. Lima is a guy who is loved in the FPL community. You can find him on Let That Whole podcast on YouTube. Lima, say hello to everyone.
Hi everyone, thanks for tuning in. We're really excited obviously to have Kenwin here, and thanks Javid for the chance to co-host with you, and nice to see Rubber Ducky here to give us that rubber seal of approval. We were to wear a rubber stamp.
All right, guys. So it gives me great privilege to welcome former Premier League forward with 195 appearances, 40 goals, 15 assists, featuring for Southampton, Sunderland, Stoke City, and Cardiff. He was the former captain of Trinidad and Tobago national men's team. He was recently appointed as the interim manager of Trinidad and Tobago women's team. The legend, Kenwin Jones. How are you doing, Kelvin?
I'm good. Good afternoon, everyone. I don't know about the legend, but happy to be a part of this spaces this afternoon. Or some probably nighttime for some people.
Thanks, Kenwin. So I would have met Kenwin at the Marriott in Trinidad while participating in a conference in May 2017. I have a picture with him and former national coach Dennis Lawrence, two very humble and nice guys. I believe that was for the World Cup qualifiers, and we beat Panama 1-0 at the Isley Crawford Stadium. That's our national stadium. So, Kenwin, my first question to you is, talk us through your relationship with Dennis Lawrence and your time as captain of Trinidad and Tobago.
Well, I think I have a very good relationship with Dennis. After making my debut for the senior team back in 2003, I went on to play for 14 years at the senior team level. And obviously, when I burst onto the scene, Dennis Lawrence was one of the senior players at that point in time. So we've built up a very good relationship over our playing careers, and not only for the national team, but while also living in the UK. Even though we were part of, different teams and such, different divisions, we still, as Trinbagonians, we still kept close, and that was further cemented, obviously, by our appearances for the national team. And then when he came on as the head coach for the men's team, I mean, the relationship wasn't any different. If anything, I think we developed an even greater bond, and that bond in itself, it remains up until this day. We still speak regularly, even though he is busy, I'm busy, but we still speak regularly, and that's that really. Also, my time as being the captain for the national team, it was a really good period for myself. It was the second, I mean, the second time around that I was the captain, but obviously the second time was a much longer period, lasted about 4 years. The first time around, I think I was the captain in back in 2010, I think, for a short time, and then things changed a little bit, and then it went back to being the same. But it was a really good time, being able to lead the players out in very important matches, and obviously bringing us through a period of stability and also progression in terms of performances and results for the national team. And right up until the end of my career, basically, it was a fantastic time, one that I'll always treasure.
That's a fascinating story, Kenwin. Thank you so much. I think for me, it's just incredible that you were able to captain your kind of national team. It's probably every kind of small boy's dream growing up to kind of just get one cap for their national team, let alone captain it. So to be able to kind of lead them to a period of stability, that just sounds like such an incredible kind of moment in your lifetime. And I'm sure you would cherish it forever. And I guess one of my questions for you to follow up would be around who were your kind of footballing idols when you were growing up related to kind of the boyhood dreams, and who's your favorite kind of all-time Premier League player?
I didn't really have dreams of, being a footballer, first of all. Football is something that I could have done really, really, really well. It was my second love. I wanted to be an athlete. That was my first love. Cricket was number three for me, but I could play all sports really well. And by the time I got to secondary school, football was the thing that I was doing the most. And I think from the age of 14, between 14 and 17, things moved super, super quick for myself. Being a part of our national under 15s, then, going on to represent the under 17s, under 20s, under 23s, and then representing the senior team, like I said, from the age of 17. So I went through all of those teams like pretty quickly, making the jump pretty quickly. Even that going on, different trials to different clubs in the UK. I did a lot of them. I did Manchester United, Middlesbrough, West Ham, Reading. I even did Glasgow Rangers twice, and Southampton, obviously. But things moved really rapid for me. And as a young boy, as a footballer, my hero was always my dad, and also my uncle. My uncle represented Trinidad and Tobago in the late 80s, early 90s. And the last time we got close to going to a World Cup, they were the team that missed out on going to the World Cup by 1 point, actually. So within my house, I had, a lot, or in my family, I should say, I had a lot of people to look up to where football was concerned. Outside of that, from the age of five, I've been supporting AC Milan. So AC Milan is the team that I always looked at, the George Weahs, the Leonardos, the Maldinis, Costa Curtas. Those were the footballers that I grew up watching, not necessarily idolizing, but watching all the time. And to be honest, I know this might be blasphemy, but I love to watch Premier League football, but I don't have a team that I support in the Premier League. That is kind of wild because I still support AC Milan, and I grew up watching Italian football. But I was fortunate enough to play against some of the best players in the world in their eras over the course of my career in the Premier League. But to actually pick one who I would say is the best Premier League player, I can't do that. I'm sorry.
You don't want anyone tweeting you off saying, "That's it, Kenwin, we're no longer friends."
Not necessarily. I respected everyone's talent. But like I say, I got to rub shoulders with, a lot of the greats of the Premier League and world football. And to pick one person that was above all of them, to me is wrong.
I agree with you philosophically. So what would you say then, just in terms of, let's say, this season, as a neutral, in terms of not supporting a Premier League club, is there a player this season who's really impressed you or who you think has taken a step up compared to prior years in the Premier League? Because I have my eye on someone who I think is the best player in the world today, and I'd be interested to hear.
Stop it. Don't go with that Salah thing. Don't do that. everybody's running, Salah is the best player in the world, but Salah is a striker though, and he is getting put in positions to be able to score. The unit that he is a part of in Liverpool, they are a well-oiled machine in their philosophy and the way that they play. So, of course, he's going to continue to shine. You're not hearing Salah doing that for Egypt.
It is very true, yeah. Maybe he'll win AFCON, but we'll see about that.
In the past, when you talk about the honorees and the Drogbas, they were doing it for club and country. So at this point in time, he is the best player currently in form at the minute. But to say overall, for you to be picking a best player in the world, I think is really, really, really hard to do that.
It is true, yeah. And so I guess,
It is.
what are your thoughts on Ballon d'Or then, just as a parting thought before we let Javid come back? Because I feel like I'm stealing all your time.
No, it's not, Ballon d'Or to me is just like anything else, is a competition that is rigged. It's one-sided.
Favoritism, yeah.
To be honest, I think you, for, as a player, it is weird for me, because I would have choose someone like a Lewandowski or a Kante, to be honest, to be Ballon d'Or winners, because when I think of the impact they have with club and country, it's ridiculous. Especially seeing where they've come from and how they've had, such a meteoric rise over the last couple of years, or 3 or 4 years as the case is. I would have gone with someone like that, but obviously, the people that actually pick the stuff, they have different ideas. So
I think
who knows?
Lewandowski deserves it. So, like, you are totally right. And when they scrapped the Ballon d'Or during the first year of the pandemic, I think it was really upsetting because that could have been his year. And this year, I would
Well, it
argue
should
that
have been.
Lewandowski
It
could do
should.
it.
It should. It should have been. It should have been. Because he's done so well over the last four or 5 years. He's been so consistent in what he's doing. Unfortunately, he was topped by Ronaldo and Messi, but he's been doing it consistently for that time. And if anyone is supposed to take it up right now, it's him.
Couldn't
If
agree
it
more.
has happened, we'll see.
Well,
Cameron, it's nice that growing up you had that support system
with your family, so they could have given you that support to chase your dreams of becoming a professional footballer. I remember growing up, I didn't have that support system.
Well, I'm not gonna say that I had that support. I think I had, what I was given was the freedom to make that choice, because while I was coming up through secondary school, obviously our school competition was pretty big. I mean, I was MVP 2 years running, doing pretty well, and I had 18 scholarship, full scholarship options. Coming down to my last year. And the thing is, I made the choice to not go on scholarship and try to go pro. The good thing is my mother supported me in that regard, and left the choice up to me, because I made my mind up. I was going to try to go pro, or I will go find a regular job and get educated later. But at the point in time, in those few years that things were such on a massive incline for me, I was like, I'm not going to stop the momentum and go to school, because if I go to school, the dream of football is over. So I just went straight for to try and go pro, and thank God it worked out in the end.
And it did work out tremendously. And that brings us to our next question. So we going back now to 2004, right? So newspaper article, South Trinidad's prodigy, Kenwyn Jones, signed for Southampton FC. Tell us about this experience, Kenwyn. What was going through your mind?
I was frustrated. I was tired, because at the beginning of that year, I was basically in the UK for about 3 months. I went back to Glasgow Rangers, spent some time there, and I was supposed to sign for Glasgow Rangers, but the academy manager at that time, he said, there are a few clubs down south, for the people in the UK, that's what the Scottish call it. There are a few people down south that want to see you. And if you don't like it, you can always come back here. I was like, well, okay. And probably that was the mistake that he made, because then after that, I went down to West Ham and Reading, and again, the both clubs wanted to sign me. After that, I went to Southampton, And at that time, it was like 3 months down the road, and I was so tired. I was exhausted from, going from club to club, knowing that everywhere that I went, they wanted to sign me, but because of the club owner that, or the person that got me to go on a couple of those trials, not all of them, they were making it difficult, for me to sign with the other places that I went to that they had nothing to do with. So, excuse me, I was so frustrated after that time, because after Southampton, I was supposed to go to Spurs after that. But when Southampton came up and they wanted to sign me, because that was one of the places that the person that got me to go on trials, that club was one of the clubs that they were dealing with. At that point in time, I was like, you know what? I'm tired. I'll just sign here and be done with it. But I mean, of course, yes, I was excited signing for Southampton as well, and being able to come to the UK and play for a club that was in the Premier League at that time. But it was just, a bittersweet moment, because like I said, I was really tired and frustrated, and the places that I really wanted to sign, before, I couldn't get to.
And that's the thing, eh? We look at transfer deadline day and we look at it like it's a big soap opera, but we really don't know what the footballers actually go through, and the stresses and strains that you all have to go through, the emotional distress, But we take it as entertainment, deadline day silence and so forth. All right, Lima, you can go ahead with the next question.
Yeah, that's really interesting to understand kind of firsthand how that feels. My question is kind of moving on to your time at Sunderland now. So if we fast forward a little bit, on 15th of September 2007, do you remember your first goal in a 2-1 home win over Reading?
Oh yeah, of course I remember that. That is a memory that will forever stay with me. Of course, our first game was at Manchester United away, so I played probably like 60 or 70 minutes in that. And then next match against Reading at home, I was really eager to be part of the fabric. So going into that game, obviously Sunderland wasn't, a mid-table club, and the squad wasn't of, the quality of players to be that mid-table to top six or whatever the case is. It was just exciting for me, being able to play in the Premier League and make my debut in front of fantastic crowd, beautiful stadium as well. And in that game, obviously I had my first goal, and I also had an assist, and we won the game. I mean, you can't ask for anything more perfect than that, because that is the stuff dreams are made of. And the thing is knowing where I've come from, and being and at that point, making a mark such as that, it was an amazing feeling. It's something that, like I said, will stay with me for the rest of my life.
Now, Kenan, a lot of people probably would not have seen this, but I saw it with you in Intercol, and I saw it before, but the world would have seen it in the Premier League, your iconic acrobatic celebration. Tell us about it, where it came from.
Well, that actually came from my uncle, to be honest. It's a celebration he used to do playing for the national team, and that is where I picked that up from. That is actually in tribute to him. Again, like I said, in the whole euphoria of 1989 and us, being so close to make it to the World Cup for the first time, that year, I mean, for the people that know about Trinidad and Tobago football, the strike squad was everything. They had probably the second biggest euphoria in the country. I mean, the first was us, obviously, in 2006, from finally making it. But before that, the strike squad was it, and all through that campaign, he's been scoring, and that was his celebration. And I just, as obviously as my uncle, just being able to carry on the legacy of that, of the name, and also the celebration to wherever I went. it was an honor for me to do that. So that is where that came from.
I love the story about your uncle as well. And as you say, growing up in a household where everyone was kind of showing you the path that had been trodden and that you could kind of then look to emulate and go down and continue that tradition. So a family of kind of very impressive athletes, it sounds like. I want to kind of take you now to November 2007, Kenwyn. So I think at the time you were linked with a £12 million move to Liverpool and Peter Crouch was going to move to Sunderland. I think again, you were linked to other high-profile clubs in the December of 2007, so just a few months later, and these included Chelsea and Liverpool. But the Sunderland manager at the time, Roy Keane, he insisted that you would be going nowhere. Tell us about this experience.
That experience was good. I mean, obviously that was still early and it was coming up to the January window, but Roy Keane was the one that brought me to Sunderland and I was doing pretty well for him, so he's not gonna say, well, he can go. He expected me obviously to stay in the team, and that was his first stint in the Premier League as well, so obviously you're gonna back your player and want them to stay with you and everything and do the best they can do for you and the club that you're at that point in time. So, but I mean, it was real interest, for the people that actually know, it was real interest, Liverpool more than Chelsea. But it didn't happen at that time. And I wasn't really focused on it. Coming up to that January window, I wasn't focused on that Liverpool thing. I was, to be honest, during my entire career, I was never really focused on all the rumors and links with this and links with that, because a lot of it sometimes is fabricated, not by clubs, but probably by agents and other people who are surrounding those agents. So a lot of the news that is out there is fabricated because, I mean, a lot of people, they try to create hysteria around something that then piques the interest of not probably the club that they mentioned per se, but other onlookers, so that they can start seeking interest and maybe get the player move. It's not something that is always concrete, and I know the fans, they get caught up in this player being able to being linked with here and being linked with there, but not all of it is factual.
Yeah, I think a lot of
That's
the time,
interesting.
yeah, I was going to say, so just a lot of the time, I guess the agents and the clubs, they all feed their own stories to the media as well to either portray a player in a bad way or to try and force the move, like we've seen with kind of what Barcelona did to Fabregas when he left my beloved Arsenal and went on strike.
They do it all the time, all the time. It's not something that is new. They create the narrative, leading up to whatever actions they want to take. So, I mean, for the fans in them, it's like a soap opera. They buy into everything. So, immediately for a lot of clubs who do not want to come off as the bad guy, they start creating the narrative within the club and then externally that then paints some of the players as the bad guys, disinterested, don't want to be at the club, don't want to trade, a bad egg, so that they can perform whatever business action they want. That is something that happens a lot and people don't understand that. But the fans, they don't buy into that because they are heart and soul. This is my club and you should want to play for my club and you should want to do this. But a lot of the times, the stuff that they say in papers is not really happening.
Guys, so see next chance when we head to the winter transfer deadline, we have it from the mouth of a Premier League forward, so we know better next time. So, Kenwyn, going back to your Sunderland period, right? Your most prolific period in the EPL was between 2007 to 2011, where you picked up most of those 40 goals and assists, right? You were Sunderland Player of the Year in 2007, 2008 season. You were compared to the likes of Didier Drogba. And tell me, was this prime Kenwyn Jones? Was this the time that you were at the peak of your powers?
No, it wasn't. I was definitely on an incline, but I don't think it was. you know, again, the life of any footballer, depending on where you come from, depending on who is the manager and the club that you're at, you know, it plays a big role in your story, the way your career is mapped out. And in 2007, 2008, of course, I was doing well. Wherever the comparisons came with the Drogba thing, I never saw that, because Drogba is himself and I myself. Yes, you might feel like because he is at a bigger club per se, and they were the talk of the town, of course, you know, the comparisons came, but I didn't really buy into that, because like I say again, to be really honest, this is my honest feeling, that there was never a better striker in the Premier League during my time in the year than I was. But that is not something that is actually mentioned. But it's fine. I could deal with that. But the 2007, 2008 period, it was good up until I got injured in the summer of 2008, because I was definitely going to Liverpool when the transfer window opened, and I got injured the month before, so that was kind of a downer. But it wasn't, I wouldn't say that it was my most prolific period, but I was definitely on the rise.
I love that, Kenwin. I love that you say, you know, you are Kenwin Jones. You are your own player. And I agree. I enjoyed watching you. I mean, I would have watched your games, you know, primarily because you are a trainee. But however, I mean, I enjoyed looking at you. You know, the physical presence, it was entertaining to look at. Go ahead to the next question, Rima.
So, Kenwin, you came very close to FA Cup glory in 2010-11 season, losing to Manchester City in the final. How did it kind of feel to play in that major cup final?
It felt great. It felt great. Also, the final was bittersweet, obviously, because we didn't win. A lot of people think that I had the chance to score, but they don't understand how literally how far I was stretching for that ball. In the end, with Joe Hart. But also, I think we were defeated, you know, before we started the game, because our regular way of playing was kind of caged up from the manager, because we were playing Man City. But I do not think that Man City did that much to trouble us. They only, you know, got on top really when they scored, and they scored probably like what, the 60 something minute or so. So it was sad that we didn't, you know, go out there and play like we usually play, because I think it would have been, you know, a really, really, really great day for us. Also, I think that was Manchester City's real turning point, you know, because they won the FA Cup that year, and from then is when they started to skyrocket. I'm not saying that they would not have been where they are today, but it would have probably been delayed maybe a year or two later on. But unfortunate for us, you know, we didn't win. But it was fantastic again to play in Wembley in front of 80 something thousand plus people in the home of football. Doing that twice, you know, the semi-final and the final, it was amazing.
If I remember correctly, it was a cagey, sticky kind of affair. It wasn't the kind of dominance we see from City now. So yeah, that was it was a good showing. It was a good game. I remember it well. And Kenwin, so now to put on my commentator voice, if I have such, right? So the game is Stoke City versus Southampton, December 29th, 2012. Stoke City's striker met Ryan Shotman's low cross with a deft touch at the near post. I don't know if you remember this game, this goal, but it was iconic. Tell us about that flick.
I mean, it's not something that I don't usually do or don't have in my locker. People were surprised. Again, for the people that watch football, when you're under certain managers, they have a way, a style of playing, and that is what you have to play, or else you would not play. For anyone that knows me from growing up, and playing football from young. I scored all types of goals, headers, left foot shots, right foot shots. It's all in there. But when you go into that system under that type of manager who likes a certain way of playing, you get, sort of automated into that. But shutting at that point, it was, I think, it within my mind as well, it was like I forget everything else and just be yourself, because I wasn't I was I think after my first year at Stoke, it was a really frustrating period being under, that type of environment and football. It was, a lot of people, yeah, they see the game, but training was horrible, to be really honest. It used to make you feel like you're losing your skill and your sense as a footballer. But again, that is your job. You have to go out there and do what the manager says and play how he says to play, because if that doesn't happen, you don't play. But I mean, the way that goal was scored is it was just a moment of ingenuity, I think. Nothing against Southampton, because a lot of people think that I'm some traitor to Southampton because of a rhetoric again of them saying that, I wanted to leave the club and blah blah blah. But people don't actually know the true story. That's the killer thing for me. They are so bent on believing that the club is so pristine, and they don't, do underhand things for business to happen. But that's just how it is.
I think after today, I would lose a lot of naivety I had before. Go ahead, Nima.
I love that. He's exposing them, and you've lost all your naivety forever. It's a good day. So, Kenwin, I personally think that you could have played for kind of Trinidad and Tobago and at the MLS for longer. So how did you make the decision to retire?
Well, I didn't really have a choice, In 2017, when we got to the halfway point of the matches for the qualifiers, just before we played Costa Rica, I was in training, and just a simple action of trying to strike a ball to goal, no real force behind it or anything. It was from across, and I just felt this twinge in my knee, and immediately after that, my knee swole as big as a helium balloon. And when that happened, I couldn't play. I went back to Atlanta United, and they, tried to do everything possible to bring it down. It wasn't going down. And then I finally went and saw a specialist, and they told me I had a tear in my meniscus. I have a hole in my cartilage. It looks like I'll have progressive degenerative arthritis, and my knee's not in good shape. The thing is, I got injured in 2008, and I had a partial tear in my ACL, and I had grade three damage on my MCL, grade three damage on my PCL, grade three damage on my LCL, and plus I had some cartilage issues. But thankfully, I did not have to do an ACL repair. I went on for years, basically, what, 9 years after that plane. And at that point in time, that is what happened. So when I went to see the specialist, he told me, well, this is what is happening with your knee right now. So to try and help you to make it to the end of the season, I had to take this injection in my knee called Synvisc, right? That was to put some like lubrication in my knee so that I'd have been fine. But he said in the end, I would have to do three surgeries. I'd have to get rid of the meniscus. I'll have to take the cartilage out of my knee. And I'll also have to do an ACL repair. And the recovery time for that, I'd have been out for 16 months, and 3 months out of that 16 months, which is at the beginning, and I had to be on bed rest. And then he said after that, you know, that recovery time, you would just be, that would just be for you to, you know, just live a normal life, but you cannot play professional sports anymore. So even if I wanted to try and force it, I would not have been able to play beyond, you know, the ending of that year. So, you know, while going through the months of I would say patching up to make it down to the end, you know, I made peace with it and said, but I had a really good run. I had a professional career for what, 15 years or so, 12 and a half years in the Premier League, you know, 2 years in the Championship, and then in Atlanta United. That was fine for me. A lot of players don't make it to that time period, and I got to 95 caps for my national team. So I was pretty contented with that. I was at peace with the decision. And obviously when 2017 ended, that was it. Called it quits.
Wow, I think that's such an impressive and long story of your career, that it lasted for so many years at a top flight, and you went to Atlanta and got to experience another country as well.
Yeah, that's how it went. Like, I mean, for a lot of people here, I'm pretty sure they could remember Michael Johnson at Man City. He was a wonder kid, and everyone was touting him to be this great, and he would have such a long career and all of that. And how long did his career last? Probably, what, 4 years, 3-4 years, something like that, before he got injured and he couldn't play again.
Yeah, so, it happens a lot.
That's the thing, you know, with footballers, people don't understand, like, they have like between 10 and 15 years when they can play the game, 15 years if you're extremely blessed. So the ones that make it to 20 years and above, they are phenomenal. You know, they are anomalies in all of this, but your career doesn't really last that long. You know, you only get to do it for a short time, and it depends on when you hit the elite side of it, how long that is going to last, you never know.
In terms of, I guess, once you finish your playing career, as you say, so if you can tell us a little bit about your appointment as the Trinidad and Tobago National Women's Team interim manager, and do you have any kind of coaching ambitions beyond that?
Well, I'll go back to front. You know, I don't plan to be a coach until I'm 60. That's one thing. Because if there's anything that I've learned from coaching so far and coaching qualifications so far, is that coaching changes every 3 years. You know, so I don't plan to be shouting at people and getting gray like really, 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 really quickly.
It's stress on your life. I think it's stress.
It is a hell of a lot of stress. It is a hell of a lot of stress.
You want to retire and live a good life,
to be honest, I started my qualifications in the 2015-2016 season when I was at Cardiff. Did that. I then went on to having that for a number of years. Obviously, went to qualification higher as well, and I also did a postgrad diploma in sports management in our university in collaboration with FIFA and their university, which is CIES, this past year. And that has been great. It gives me such an all-around knowledge of how to marinate all the elements that is surrounding, you know, football administration, how to talk to blend, I would say, the team structure, the managerial structure, the coaching structure, and kind of have all of those elements working together to produce the best product. And then, well, we've gone through a series of ups and downs, really, where our football and administration is concerned over the last few years, and the position of being the interim manager for the women's team, you know, it came up because, like I said, we've been through some ups and downs, and we had one coach that was here. He left. they put someone in who I believe should not have been put in that position. And then they rang me and I was like, well, I'm free. I'll do it.
Well, Kenwin, you know, just to let you all know, Kenwin is unbeaten as a manager right now. Huh? So he started off with a very good record.
But soon to be. That never lasts too long. You know, football is something that you cannot predict. And on the day, you need everything to go right for you in order to win. So it's only been two matches, but I definitely think that there's a lot of room for improvement and for the team to build and to go on. And my sincere belief is that the team can qualify for the Women's World Cup in 2023. Whether or not we get there is another thing, but I do have the belief in the squad that is currently constructed at the moment.
And we will be supporting you 100% on the route. Kenwin, as you know, this chat, we call it FPL Dialogue, right? So the spaces is usually about Fantasy Premier League. As we know, FPL for short. Did you play FPL as a player or do you play now?
Well, I don't know how you all do it. I played FPL once, right, while I was at Stoke. We had our own league in the dressing room. I mean, I finished like fifth in the league, but I really don't know how you all do it. And reason being is that I don't trust the human beings. You know, as players, you go out there and y'all are fans, you'll see, well, all right, people are on form and whatever, but I'm seeing the human being and I know the human being, anything can happen on the day. So y'all are really taking chances in putting people in your team and hoping that they give you the points. And I don't know, like right now, I really just can't be bothered with it. You know, people get so drawn in to to their fantasy league and who they put and who's not giving them points. I've seen some people come close to suicidal after, you know, making choices that don't produce the results, you know, and even worse, being a coach, I understand that. So I'm trying to stay away from all that heartache.
And Kenwin, you won't believe right now, there are some spaces on mental health for FPL. It has been very, very serious. Very serious. And we try to let people know that at the end of the day, it's a game.
I won't doubt that. Because, I mean, at the end of it, obviously, there's a prize at the end, right? A lot of FPLs, they have a cash prize at the end. So people want to win that prize. So then when you're picking these players and they're not giving you what you need on the day, a lot of people, they get angry, they get frustrated. And even on the day that you take someone out, you know, in the hopes of putting someone else in to get the points, and the person that you took out firstly, they did so well and then you don't have the points from them. So it's a roller coaster. It's a serious roller coaster of emotions. And there's no guarantee that you're going to make the right choices in the end, you know, to have you in that zone where you can win the prize. So I try to stay away from that. I like my life, you know, stress-free as much as possible.
So, guys, we are now at the interesting part of the dialogue where you could go ahead and ask your questions to Kenwin. You could do that in a few ways. You could either DM myself or Nima. You could request a mic, raise your hands first, or you could hashtag FPL Dialogue, and we will get your questions. So we have the first question from Chief at FPL Hints. Chief is another love guy in this community, and Chief has been responsible for my little growth in the FPL community. So go ahead, Chief.
Yeah, hi, Javed. Hi Nima, hi Robert Ducky, and hi Kenwin. Thank you so much. Yeah, how's it going? All good?
Yeah, the pleasure is absolutely mine. I'm happy to be within the space speaking to everyone.
Thank you so much for your time. No, it's been a privilege hearing your insights as a former professional footballer, and with me being a former footballer and a manager of sorts, and also I was really touched by the start of your conversation when you mentioned AC Milan and how growing up they were a team that you followed. We are of a similar age, and those players that you name checked, you know, that really brought a lot of you know, nostalgia back to me as well. There's so many questions I could ask you, right? But one question I was really keen to ask, right, is, you know, you mentioned Milan, you mentioned Serie A. Was there ever a point in your career where you were potentially linked to move to play in Italy, or did you ever have an interest to play in Italy out of interest?
I never had that link, you know, unfortunately. I would have loved to have it, but then I would not have gone to Italy and played for anyone else. That's the thing.
Yeah.
So if it wasn't them, I wasn't going to go and just play in Italy for the sake of. I really love AC Milan. I bleed red and black, the Rossoneri, as people call it. And I try every year to, I mean, now I could do it. You know, before, when I was playing, you know, I would never be seen in someone else's kit, or to say that I have my name on it. I had a couple of presents for my kids, because they know I support AC Milan, so they would get me shirts every year. But now I can do it. You know, I had last season shirt. I haven't gotten this season shirt yet. Mm-hmm. I had all the colors for last season. You know, I'll put it on. I'll go out in public because I feel like I can be like a true fan now and do that. But apart from that, I just analyze football from everywhere else. But with AC Milan, I'm a fan, so I watch it as a fan. But for everywhere else, I analyze football and look at it from a coaching point of view. And that didn't just start, you know, just because I went through the coaching education. That is something I was doing from a very young age.
Of course. And just another question I really want to bring up. You mentioned about your uncle played for Trinidad Tobago in the 80s, and that they're just one point off from qualifying. And yet, 2006 World Cup, you were there, Trinidad and Tobago famously qualified. And I remember watching that match in England against Trinidad and Tobago, and you guys really pushed us right to the end, right? And just so unfortunate you didn't get a positive result in that game. And, you know, thankfully from an England perspective, we got very lucky with the 3 points. I just want to ask, how did it feel, you know, taking the field in that historic match for Trinidad and Tobago, and then, you know, playing against fellow Premier League players as well? Just could you sum up how that could you sum it up in words, perhaps, how it felt on that historic day?
Well, it was fantastic, because to me, I think I was relatively unknown because I was still at Southampton at that time. Southampton got relegated in 2005, at the end of 2005 season, I think. So, you know, I was relatively unknown. But at the same time, I can remember my debut actually in the Premier League was against Liverpool, right, for Southampton. I came on for like 5 minutes towards the end, but also before the game, I can remember going out into the tunnel and standing next to the Hippias and Steven Gerrard and Carragher, and being 18 years old at that time in 2004, wow. I was like, you know, wow, this is Steven Gerrard. You know, no disrespect to him, but I'm almost the same height as him. I couldn't believe, well, you know, this is the person that everyone was hyping about, Steven Gerrard. Well, we're almost the same size. All right. Well, you know, I deserve to be here. But when, I mean, obviously on the field, Steven Gerrard is on, you know, a different level. And, you know, that was my first introduction. And I also, my second game that I got some minutes in right after that was against Birmingham. We played Birmingham away. So that was my introduction into the Premier League, even though it was brief. And then I went back out on loan to Stoke in 2005. They were in like League One or Championship or whatever. No, they were Championship. And then Southampton got relegated at the end of that season. And I had the one season in the Championship with Southampton. And then the move came to Sunderland. So coming up against the Beckhams and the Owens and Rooney's and Joe Cole's, Ashley Cole, Ferdinand's, I mean, you name it, that squad was stacked at that point in time. I didn't feel jitters or anything. You know, I was just happy to be out on the pitch to mix it up in between them and then to let them know what was coming in the future.
And just one final question, a fantastic insight there as well, that you were a small group of players who have that unique experience of playing under Roy Keane as a Premier League manager. And I just wanted to know, like, obviously we know how he is from the outside, the hard man reputation, how he is as a pundit. I'm just really curious to know, how was he as a manager from on a man-to-man basis?
Well, I think he's no different. But I also think that he's misunderstood. I think he's not malicious. He's very honest. I never had a problem with him. To be really honest, my view of Roy Keane is that he needed more experience around him in his backroom staff in order for him to become the manager that he wanted to be. Unfortunately, he didn't have that, but I had a really good time under him. You know, I mean, all the reports of players saying this, that, the other, I had a different view. I mean, I come from Trinidad and Tobago, you understand? So,
yeah.
I mean, Roy Keane, you know, he is Roy Keane. Yes, I have massive respect for him, but there's nothing that Roy Keane could say to actually, you know, rock my mental or take me off course or have me feeling insecure or anything like that. And to be honest, we had a really good relationship. We used to talk a lot. Most of the times when the training pitch, when we had our scrimmages, he would join in. He would be on my team, and we would have, you know, we would have a fun time. I can remember one time we were in training and we were playing this scrimmage, and he played this ball to me, and instead of playing a 1-2 with him, I actually took the ball and turned, had a shot and score. And then while running back, he said to me, "I'm so lucky that I scored that. I can see them rip my head off." But we laughed about it because at the end of the day, you know, he's the manager, I'm the player, I'm going to be going out on the pitch and playing. But what people don't understand about Roy Keane is that he tries to make players understand that
there are 7 or 8 billion or close to 9 billion people in the world. People that get to play football, number one, is not a lot. People who get to play football at that level is also not a lot. So when you have that moment, you have to grab it with both hands and also give your 100% every single day, because it's not a guarantee for you to be in that position. But as times change, you know, the characters of the generations change and the mindsets, and people couldn't deal with that honesty. You know, I mean, some of the things, you know, people would say that he's saying is harsh, but it's some of the things that I would say, to be honest. You know, it's no different. But like I say, I come from where I come from. It's probably like 6,000, between 6,000 and 8,000 miles to get to the UK. My country, it is 1.4 million. That's probably Birmingham, you know. So for me coming so far, it was just a fantastic experience for me. And he gave me full confidence, and I think I returned that back to him as well.
Absolutely. And yeah, just one thing I wanted to say. There's so many more questions I could ask. I won't ask any more. I just want to say that, you know, you've always had a presence about you whenever I saw you play in the Premier League. And I just want to wish you all the best in your management career. You know, you're a fantastic person, and all the best, Kenwyn.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Ash. We have Nick. Nick, you could go ahead and ask Kenwyn your question.
Good evening, all. Just two questions for you, Kenwyn. Seeing that you have experienced the playing career, if you can go back to your younger days, what advice would you give your younger self as you look to enter the Premier League or even just enter the sport of football from your earliest age? What advice do you think you could give yourself that would help you to progress differently?
Wow, to progress differently, I don't think there's any advice I would give myself, because like my pathway into football and even into the Premier League was much different to a lot of players, you know, so I'm happy with that. What I would say for myself, maybe over my career I could have been a bit more selfish, you know, in a lot of things that I did, but then that is not a true representation of my character. So, you know, there's not much advice. I think, again, like, people don't
they don't understand. I come from Trinidad and Tobago, the Caribbean. While going to school, I had many challenges to even play while I was in school, and the things I'd have to do, how early I'd have to get up in the morning to go train before school starts in my school. You know, I went through all of that. I went through not having transportation to get from school to home. I'd have to walk along, you know, I don't know, maybe I can't even put it into a distance, to be honest with you. But I had to walk sometimes after practice in the evenings, and I would get home at night time, still have to go do my schoolwork and then get up the next day, go training or have a game. And I persevered through many things. So I'm quite comfortable with the things that I did growing up, you know, to become a footballer and all the obstacles that I would have faced. So there's nothing else that I could go back and tell myself, well, you need to do X, Y, and Z, because I'm a true testament of determination and hard work and perseverance.
Okay, understood. And the next question is, I know you spoke earlier on about the media. They create different rumors and articles stating that the players would rebel or they'd force a transfer. As a former player, is there anything that you think players could do, or do you feel that players should be able to speak up and just vent out to the public that we are not doing this, or you think?
Well, now is a different time. You know, our players have a lot more power now to be able to say stuff. It still might not produce the right result, but they have a lot of power now and a little bit more freedom to say stuff. You know, as time changes, I've seen, you know, with my own eyes within clubs, when a club doesn't want a player, they have them, you know, training on their own, training with like the academy, coming in early to the training ground and not being able to leave like till like 5 and 6. And that type of stuff, and trying to mess with them mentally so that they will give up and not fight to get, you know, whatever payout for them to leave or whatever the case is. I've seen all of this with my eyes, you know, so it's not to say there's a situation where a player could come out and say the club needs to do X, Y, Z, and it will change. It just forces them now to behave a lot better in how they go about their business. You know, it's amazing, and it happens all the time, but now situations are changed, and players who are in form and at big clubs, they can get their way. But like I say, there's nothing that they can really do. They can speak freely now, but they can't really do much anymore.
All right, thanks, Kenan. We have a question from FPL Miltoners. FPL Miltoners, go ahead.
I've just got a quick question. What was the hardest defender you've ever played against?
You know, funny enough, people used to talk about, I mean, you know, the known defenders, but they play much smarter. They have nothing to prove. It's the ones that have nothing to prove and trying to fight their way. So you would go to West Brom and you would have, you know, what's his name? He was Swedish, left footer. Oh my gosh, I forgot his name. Or you'd go to Burnley and it would have Tarkowski. One of the two. I'm sorry, I'm really terrible with the names right now. But those were the players, Zach Knight at times, Cahill when he was at Bolton. They had a lot to prove at that time because they were at the smaller clubs and they were trying to get moves. I mean, when you go to Manchester United or Chelsea or Liverpool or Arsenal, you tend to have a much easier time. I'm not saying that the defenders are not going to defend well, but you have a much easier time because they are already established. You know, it's the ones who are down in the gutter that really, really gets on your nerves.
Yeah, one more question as well. While you were playing at, like, all them clubs, did you feel like when you move club it like was a big impact, or did it like feel the same or anything?
It depends. I mean, the only regret I would have is not going to like a big club, you know, to
not necessarily for the size of the club, but that is where you could have experienced a different type of football and manager and environment. Because, I mean, I was stuck with some pretty, I would say, traditional managers at Stoke and at you know, part of Sunderland and that type of stuff. So the football didn't really change. And coming from Trinidad and Tobago, I've experienced different managers with different styles and different types of football, but it was unfortunate that I couldn't get to somewhere that had a different type of football. I mean, for a long period of time, I was happy when I went to Bournemouth for a short period and experienced Eddie Howe. He's a great manager, a great coach as well, someone that I speak to all the time. And he actually really, you know, inspired me to be or to become a manager like him, just in the way that he go about his detail and how he trains his intensity, his attention to detail, and the type of confidence he gives to his players to go out and play against anyone. You know, but apart from that, you know, I'd go to clubs and obviously it would lift for some time, but then, you know, they go back into the same tradition of how they built, how they play. And it just kind of petered out that way. But to be honest, I enjoyed all my clubs that I went to and played for. It was a fantastic time. It was like tourism in a way for me, because again, I'm not from the UK, I'm from Trinidad and Tobago. So going out there, it was life experience for me and I enjoyed it.
Kenwin, I know when we spoke earlier, you gave me a timeline. How are we going on that?
Well, we add that timeline, but you can get 10 more minutes.
All right. So the next question I have from you is from our FPL Hall of Famer, Pras. Pras, you could go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Javed. Kenwin, it's a pleasure to have you and fascinating to hear everything you've been saying. I'll keep it brief. A couple of questions from me. The first one is, you know, the most memorable occasion or memories that us fans have is the FA Cup final. You know, that day is so special. Just wanted to hear from you in that 2011 final that you were involved in. Obviously, you know, Stoke eventually didn't end up winning. But how was that for you as a player to be part of a final? You know, the whole process of it, playing in that.
It was fantastic. And it was fantastic for many reasons. Yes, one of the reasons playing in Wembley in the FA Cup final, a lot of players don't get to do that in their career. But what kind of toppled it for me was the fact that I was able to have my dad out there. I started playing football because of him, my uncle, and it was always their dream to be in Wembley or to play in Wembley. I mean, so at that time, you know, I was very fortunate to be able to have my dad over and some other family members, you know, witnessing that final. So that is what kind of topped the moment for me. I mean, of course, yes, we lost, but at the same time, for myself, it was a historic moment.
Brilliant. Thank you for that. Second one, I'm going to bring in a little bit of the FPL element into it. And I know that you don't play today, but, you know, when we as FPL players, we think about a fixture coming up and we say, look, Salah has got a hat-trick against this team 3 times in the last 5 seasons. I wanted to hear from you as a player. Is this, you know, this intangible thing that you can't measure when you went to a stadium where you'd scored a hat-trick in the past or you played a team which you've done well against in the past, is that real? Is that something that you take into the game? How much of that is, you know, we should take that into account?
Sometimes you do. And again, it depends on the player and the club that he is playing for. You know, a lot of players might go through that thought process that you have. You know, you usually score against them. So, okay, you're looking forward to getting a goal. The team that you play for, they're in form. They are top of the table. They're whatever. They you know, so you want to get on the score sheet and continue your run. There are also moments where players go into games and they're thinking, oh, well, I need to have a good game here because I think I've been having a sour patch, or I'm just getting a chance to play, so I need to put on a performance. There are many different thought process that goes into to a player performing you know, at any given time. It just depends on your situation and the club you're at and where your club is in the table.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your answers. Javed, well done for getting Kevin in here. It's been, you know, really amazing listening
No problem, Praz. I appreciate your questions and I appreciate, you know, everything that you asked so far.
All right, Kenwin, I'm going to just have one speaker ask you a question. And
sure.
Right, so after my question, Keon, you could, Keo James, you could go ahead. I had a question from a DM, Kenwin, and I find it was a pertinent question. Do you have any superstitions before a game?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, at the end of the day, I think once you prepare well, you know, the game will come as it is. A lot of players have superstitions. They put on the left sock before they write, or they would listen to music, or they will do such and such. For me, you know, I just do everything to relax. So I'd come in, I'd get a little massage, do my stretching, listen to some music. You know, it depends, but I never had anything specific that I needed to do to get ready for a match.
Okay, Keon, you could go ahead and ask Kenwin your question.
Oh, good afternoon, Kenwin. I just have one quick question. Who is the greatest player you ever played against? Not just defender. You know, you watch a player like Steven Gerrard and be like, wow, he is really great. You know, that's something we always wanted to find out as a fan. You know, they say Messi, Ronaldo, but who on the pitch like wowed you as a player?
Well, to be honest, I played against the who people are calling the greatest players to ever play the game, Ronaldo and Messi. So, you know, in terms of that, that is probably the highlight of it. I mean, for me personally, my viewpoint is Ronaldinho is the best player in the world ever. But for a lot of people, they have different ideas. But that's just me personally. I mean, I look at Ronaldo and I give him his kudos. I give Messi his kudos as well. But they don't make me feel like how Ronaldinho made me feel. You know, so Ronaldinho for me all day, every day of the week.
Makes you happy, right, watching him?
Hugo Bonita. Thank you, Kenwin.
No problem. Thanks for your question.
So, guys, Kenwin would have given us more time than what he allocated to us. I just want to thank Kenwin from the bottom of my heart. Kenwin, we appreciate you. You are a legend to me, and we just thank you for being on this space. Again, I was so naive before this space. Some of that naivety would be gone now. It was so much of insight, and we just thank you so much for having this chat with us, Kenwin. And we will continue the FPL talk when Kenwin makes his leave.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me. I hope everyone's families in this chat is in a good place right now, because obviously we're in a pandemic. But I did enjoy the time that I was here with you. I hope you all go on to do well in your FPL leagues and no one gets, you know, too frustrated. But hopefully at some point in time we could do this again, you know. But thank you all for even listening. It's not something that you have to do. So I appreciate all of you, and hopefully we can do this in the future again.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Bye-bye.
Take care.
All right, guys. So now I hand you over to FPL Rubber Ducky. Rubber Ducky, you could go ahead and host some FPL talk. Rubber Ducky, my first question to you. Should I do
Havertz? Don't ask about Kane.
And could you tell us about what you expect as the Conte impact or effect on Spurs to get the ball rolling?
Jesus, what a question. Should you do Havertz to Son? Not this game week. I think you've got to give them a big wait and see. I think people are just doing the typical FPL, getting a little bit too excited and want to jump on that ship straight away. It's a very poor Spurs team at the moment. And Conte will obviously improve them. He's a fantastic manager, but it's going to take time. I don't think the international break actually helps Conte, because a lot of his main players that he's going to want to work with, they're not going to be around. They're going to be on international duty. So his turnaround of the squad is going to take even longer. I'd keep Havertz for this week. I'd wait and see how they play under Everton, but I don't think it's going to tell us a hell of a lot. Conte plays with two up front, so that more than likely will be Son, which makes him a fantastic asset, theoretically. Theoretically a better asset than Kane. The problem with having Son over Kane is it more than likely, although it probably doesn't mess with your team structure, I know ours are all different, but if you want to hop around with your premiums, which is quite popular with people still have faith in Ronaldo, you can't really do that too easily when your Tottenham premium is going to be Son, apart from Kane, because if you're going Kane, you can do the switch, being the forward Kane, Ronaldo, Lukaku, even if you're that crazy. But if you're going Son, it's going to take you two transfers to do it every time, because you're changing a premium midfielder to a premium forward and whatnot.
You left out Aubameyang as well. Just add him in. He's back to 10 million again. Back to premium status.
He's got a premium price, but he's not a premium player. So, yeah, all right, fine, whatever. Aubameyang. Look, Conte has his work cut out. He clearly has, if the stories are true, he's asked for a big kitty to spend money, and he can't spend it till January. And you probably won't even spend it all in January, because you can't get the players you really want in January. Although with the pandemic and stuff, Premier League players, clubs seem to be the only ones with money, and there could have been players itching to leave clubs for the last 18 months. So that'll be interesting, although it is still hard to do it mid-season. From an FPL point of view, Tottenham are a huge wait and see. Still. There's a lot of talk, get on them now before everybody else does. I think you could possibly be beating FPL players who jump early and go too early, because there's still some great players out there that they're going to be dropping out of their squad to get Kane. Like, a lot of them will be dropping Vardy to get Kane. Vardy's got some cracking fixtures coming up. And if you have him, keep him. The easy one is obviously the Havertz one, because Chelsea's fixtures end. And who else are you going to really get? Benrahma's fixtures aren't great. Rafinha's fixtures are okay. You might already have him anyway. To sum it up, I think Spurs is still a wait and see. But if you're behind and you want to take the gamble, do it now. But you really are just basing it on fixtures rather than form. And it's not even average form. It's very poor form.
Right. So we have a question from FPL Mo. FPL Mo, you can direct your question to Robert Ducky, Lima, Chief, Pras. They are all great at FPL. So just direct your question to whoever you want it to be answered.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, do you think Doherty could be a good asset again with Conte playing wingbacks?
In terms of Tottenham wingbacks, they could be better players, but I wouldn't touch them, because they're not going to be as good as the City and Chelsea and Trent. I mean, really, at this point, we should have fairly template defences, a mixture of, you know, Chilwell, James, Cancelo, Trent, and then you're going to need Livramento for your budget. I don't think it's worth the risk of bringing them in at the expense of one of those players. As I'm saying, if you're chasing, maybe give it a go, but I wouldn't be jumping on board any Spurs defence. As I said, Conte's a great manager, but Christ, he's going to have to be the best manager in the world to turn Dier into a decent centre-back. So, like, you know, I just wouldn't do it.
And those are the comments why we love FPL Rapadocki so much. Ash, you could go ahead.
I actually had a question. Sorry to interject there. A question for Mr. E, who I know is a Norwich City fan. I started Norman last game week, and Norman for Norwich was agonizingly close to score against Leeds on two occasions, right? The second attempt just whizzed past the post. So my question for Mr. E is, should I start him again, or should I reserve him to bench for the status again?
I'd say thank you very much as well for bringing us in, but It's do or die for us now in this match. Like we said, it was do or die before Leeds, and as a Norwich fan, it's basically do or die every match until Christmas when we realise we're down and we're just going to prepare for next year in the inevitable. If he's going to score, he's going to score next week against Brentford. You've seen what he's like. You've seen that he's a guy who just will shoot on sight, who will have as much of an attempt as possible. If we can grind out a draw, he'll get you 3 points. And if he gets lucky with one of his amazing bloody, you know what, I'm going to shoot from here because it's 40 yards out, but I've got legs larger. Like, he makes Ronaldo look like he missed leg day. Like, so if he gets one of those on target, he was meant to be on set piece duty, but the problem was last week was Kieran Dowell was back.
Yeah.
So Kieran Dowell then came in and started sharing the set piece duty with him. So as long as Daldinho, as we like to call him, doesn't play, then Norman's on all the set pieces again. And yeah, I'd say he's staying in my team. He's staying in my team for this week because Brentford is a possible game. Our fixtures look good as well. So if he can score against Brentford, or if we can turn something around against Brentford, then he's got the potential to go on and do stuff against. We've got Newcastle. We've got some other tin pot teams coming up. So we have the potential. I would say give him one more week, see what happens against Brentford. If we lose against Brentford, I think that's the end of Daniel Farke. I think that's the start of something else, and I'd say sell him.
This is it. Like, with Farke, right, I'm just surprised that Norwich just, like, the board love him for some reason. Do you actually think they'll sack him this time if he just keeps on losing?
Well, so the chat in the Norwich City communities at the moment is, is he the best? This is how fucking dire things are for us. The chat for us now is he the best manager to get us back up? We're already relegated over at Norwich. So we're now talking about, is he the best manager to get us back out of the Championship again next season? And that's why, you know, he's just re-signed a five-year deal, I think. So it'll cost an absolute fortune, which we don't have. The only way that we'll lose him, I think, is if he gets snapped up by... there's talk that I think Wolfsburg, somewhere in Germany, want him. And if that's true, then potentially he'll go there. And, like, I think he loves the club. I think the one of the reasons he's clinging on to his job so hard is because he loves the club. And the fans love him. But the problem is that it's starting to get sour. It's starting to get toxic. And this man who we love, who you cannot take away what he has done in three seasons, I think three seasons, maybe four, he's delivered us two titles. You know, a record-breaking title for the club as well. The man will always be a legend. And what I hate at the moment is watching a legend. This must be what it must be like for an Arsenal fan during the Wenger out days. Like, someone who had delivered them so much. Arsenal didn't deserve all that stuff, but they got there because Wenger was fucking brilliant. And then he started losing it, and then he held on for so long, it was toxic. It was horrible. And I do not want that for Daniel Farke.
Yeah, and just an observation on Norman, just for everyone, like, joking aside, right? Like, he's owned by 0.01% of managers in my ranked here, right? So I started him on the off chance that he might score. Some of his underlying stats are quite interesting. Of course, wasn't on set pieces last week, as a mystery mentioned, right? The thing I found interesting in that match, again, I watched him like a hawk, right? I also watched Rafinha. They're my two interests in that match. Rafinha, wonder goal. And, you know, we know how he went. But with Norman, the interesting thing was his heat map and also where his positioning was didn't look that good. But ironically, at most times, he seemed like Norwich's most attacking player. Like, at times, he seemed like, you know, out of nowhere, just pop in with a shot. Like, oh, where did he come from? And
that's what he's going to give you, though, Ash. He's not going to give you attacking. He's not an attacking midfielder.
He's
a central defensive midfielder. We bought him in as a tank, but he's a central defensive midfielder who, imagine Lampard and Gerrard when they were in their later days, when they didn't have the legs to be attacking midfielders anymore. But they'll sit back. But all of a sudden, you'll see them just on the edge of the D and they will spank one into the corner.
Yeah.
And I think that, for me, is where I see Norman's gameplay. That he's not going to be there playing up front. He's not going to be getting all the assists. He's not going to be doing all the passes into Pukki, although he did get a pass into Pukki. He's going to be the one who, that ball's going to come bouncing back to him and he's going to spank it in, or he's going to take one from the set pieces, either free kick or corner or something like that. And we're reasonable enough with those things that, as I say, I'm playing him next week. And then depending on what happens with the result, if we lose to Brentford and we lose a manager, I think he's going to have to go just... Actually, he might not, but he might go to the bench. He might go to the bench and warm the bench up, because at 4.5 mil, you can't really complain of having a bench warmer there who should be playing week in, week out, regardless of who the manager is.
Yeah.
But I'd wait until he comes into form until I bring him back into the team. But he's getting one last game week for me.
I'll tell you what, you've convinced me to move him from sub 2 to sub 1 right now. And maybe I just need that extra push to get him on the pitch. But yeah, like...
Yeah. Check out his Instagram, Ash. Just look at the size of him. When you look at those muscles, you'll realise there's no way you can't play him. That man loves the gym.
Oh, no. Okay, I'm going to have to do that. Cheers, cheers for the insight, mate. Thank you.
So right, I have a question for Pras. Pras, we got a DM question directed that was specifically directed to you. What should we do with Mikel Antonio?
Well, I think... firstly, it's team dependent, and which is obviously the case for everyone. I think if you have a Kane already in your team, and you know your team is set up in a way that you can't get to a Tony, you can't fund a Son in midfield, and you need to downgrade Antonio, that's the only situation where I understand that selling him may work. But personally, I think, look, the guy is putting up numbers that are far above his price point. Even though they have dipped ever so slightly in the last 3 or 4 game weeks, they're still, you know, he's top 3 for most of the stats, XG, XGI. He looks on the eye to be fully involved, even though he didn't get a return in the last game. He was very, very close to it. So, look, I mean, tough fixtures or not, I can talk about my team. I'm certainly planning to keep him. There was a tweet that I put out earlier, I think yesterday, which was saying that, look, if you're not confident in starting him against Liverpool, Chelsea or City, we also are blessed with a lot of cheap options that can come on if you wanted to. For example, Mbeumo plays Norwich the same week that Antonio plays Liverpool. Similarly, you know, Huang has good fixtures at the same time. There was Livramento also who has good fixtures at the same time. So, you know, you don't have to sell him if you don't think he's going to do well in those 3 fixtures. But the one key thing that swung it for me is we will definitely need him back after this. Because after this, he has a fantastic run where he plays Leeds, Norwich, Watford. You know, those are fixtures you definitely want him for. So for me personally, if you can find a way of keeping him, keep him. If you're not confident of playing him, then think about benching him. But I would, you know, at least against Liverpool, he, you know, he should be starting.
Thanks, Pras. Always insightful and enjoyable to hear from you. FPL Junkie, I know you had a question. You can go ahead and take the forum.
Yeah, I just wanted to check if anybody's thinking about Carney or Cornet from Burnley as a midfield option at 6 million, because he's had some attacking returns in the past few games.
Docky, you want to take this one?
I think it's all about Spurs. If you're lucky enough to have the Spurs assets, or maybe you don't fancy Spurs, you might want to look at him. But I'm worried about that one stat that he has, that he has a Burnley shirt on his back. So I haven't been looking at him. Although he has been impressive, it's the teammates around him, which are a worry. I haven't been looking at him. But if you don't have any fires and you fancy a punt... Yeah, why not?
I've got absolutely no fires right now. I'm just thinking whether he can be a differential for a couple of game weeks.
Well, aren't you lucky? Do you have Son or Kane and both? Or...
No, I'm not planning to get them for at least 2-3 game weeks. As much as I know what Conte can do, like you said, he doesn't have the time and he's not a miracle worker. I don't think he can... I mean, for him to play a back five, he needs 3 good, you know, centre-backs, right? And like you said, Dyer and Sanchez don't excite me. So I don't see how either, you know, Doherty or Royal or even Reguilon will benefit. And I don't want to change my team structure to try and get in either Kane or Son. So I'm not planning to get any Spurs assets as of right now.
Yeah, look, yeah, the only benefit of that is if Conte knows he hasn't got the defenders. But he wants that system. He knows he's going to have to maybe score 3 goals to win a game. And he's just going to give Son license. I mean, Son's quicker than Kane. And he likes his players to be full-blooded, hard-working, you know, run your ass off. He worked some hard in training.
Yeah.
Son's going to be his main man up front.
Yeah.
He doesn't really appreciate somebody like Kane who can't sprint to save his life. He doesn't suit his type of game. I'm not saying he's going to drop Kane, but it's going to be all about feed Son, get him to run onto the ball and see what he can do. Yeah, it could be a benefit that he knows he can't defend. They just have to score goals to win games.
Yeah, but again, I'll wait for a couple of game weeks, look at the eye test, how
yeah.
the team plays. And how
yeah, yeah.
Because I
think it makes sense.
Yeah, because every time I think of Son and Kane, it reminds me of the match against United, and Van Bissaka was quicker than Son. So, you know, I'm not too keen right now. But then, again, that was under no.
It's very expensive.
Yeah.
It's very expensive when you get the wrong player in. It's a transfer to get them in. It's a transfer to get them out. You've missed out a player you probably would have had instead of them. Yeah. I have no problem waiting. Some people think you've got to jump now. No.
I remember this legendary manager who got him. He didn't want to wildcard, so he got in Kane. He didn't perform. So next game, he wildcarded, gone and got in Son. Yeah. He didn't perform either. Yeah,
we know who you're talking about.
You know what I mean? So yeah. I don't want to risk that right
now. Was Kane in his wildcard team?
No, he
I don't know the wildcard team.
So he moved out Lukaku, got in.
Oh, so he took him
out. He took out Lukaku to get Kane. Kane did nothing. And then he wildcarded to get in Son. And then Son did nothing.
This is it. We all know who that was.
I think Neymar does.
Guys, so we're going to take like a couple of questions again. And because Neymar has to go and catch a flight. So we don't want to make him miss his flight.
One last thing. It's 3:30 a.m. in India, so I'm off as well. I'll see you guys in the next space. Good night, everyone.
All right, Junkie. Night.
See you later, Junkie.
Night, Junkie.
Good night, everyone.
All right, so FPL, Milton, I know you had a question. You could go ahead.
I've got a question for Ash. So I've got Azpilicueta, Havertz, and Antonio, and Diaz, and I've got two free transfers, but I'm not really sure what to do. Like, they're the transfers I'm looking to like take out.
Yeah, it's just a shame. Like, Azpi seemed like a must-have a few weeks ago, and now, like, it's just one that you want to drop. Diaz, again, I've got Diaz in my team, but I'm looking to ship him out in the short term anyway. And you've got two free transfers, and you've got Havertz as well. Good for me. And you've got no other Chelsea defenders, is that right? You've just got Aspi only.
Yeah.
And you've got Rudiger. And I'm guessing, like, just by listening to those names, Diaz, Rudiger, Aspi, you went for what you perceived to be the safer options at that time. Is that right? Is that right?
I didn't go for, like, a Chua or anything.
See, I'm in a situation, right, where I can relate on the Diaz front. You know, he's up against United. I think United will be really pumped up for that match. Even if they lose, I think they'll score, right? So my thinking right now is to... And I've got two free transfers as well, by the way. Oh. I haven't got Havertz. My thinking is this, right? That, look, there's an international break literally around the corner, right?
Should I get Smith-Rowe in that international break?
I didn't catch what you said there, sorry.
Do you think, was you going to say, sorry?
I was going to say that, like, as tempted as I am to use my two free transfers now, I'm probably going to just use one, right? The thing is that, like, with Havertz, he's got, what, Burnley, right? In the next match. He could easily score against them, right, for all we know. So I think a Havertz to Smith-Rowe move, I wouldn't recommend it at this moment.
Yeah.
Oh, the week after. Yes. Potentially. Give him one more chance and then ship him out the week after. But for this week, I don't even say this is a safe move, but, like, for me, I've got Chilwell, right? And I want to get James in. Like, James just looks sensational right now. And my thinking is that, again, James did not start in the Champions League for Chelsea during the week. So I'm hoping that he starts against Burnley. So for me, again, similar situation, two free transfers. I've got Diaz as well. I'm really drawn towards Diaz to James right now, just because that way I've got him in my team. You know, he's still relatively low owned. And then I've got the two free transfers
for the after the international break. And here's the kicker for me. I don't want Diaz, right? So I can get rid of him. I'll get James in. Two free transfers. And if I really want to, Cancelo, I can get him in after the international break. So then I've got Trent, Cancelo, James, and Chilwell after the international break. So that's what I... So I guess what I'm saying is, like, ship out Diaz for James, potentially. Again, it's up to you what you want to do. But then, you've got Aspi as well. Potentially could ship him out as well. But, yeah, I mean, there's not much that I wouldn't say do a full-on DIY, but potentially move out Diaz. Now, will City keep a clean sheet against United? That's also possible. But it's just getting those attacking Chelsea players in right now before the ownership, becomes really sky high. But James's ownership, when he got that massive haul last weekend, was less than 10%. I'm pretty certain it's less than 20% now. It's only going to go up and up and up. And so long as he's not playing in the Champions League, he's not playing in the cup games, I'd expect him to play in the league. But that's the only real move I could suggest, unless you had anything else on your mind.
I have a question directed specifically to FPL Robert Ducky. And this is from your truly friends, Robert Ducky. How do you feel about Conor Gallagher now?
How do I feel about Conor Gallagher?
Yeah, you have to love him now.
Oh, well, I especially loved him for the players who had him on their bench and he came off their bench. Lucky bastards. Conor Gallagher, he had a good game. Well done. Congratulations. Crystal Palace's fixtures are looking good. If you don't have any fires, and that's the only, you have the perfect team and you want to start looking at him, by all means. But yeah, that's not going to happen every week. I mean, to be honest, he's lucky he was playing. He should have been sent off before. The guy should have been suspended. So he's been a very lucky boy. But look, it's not, to be honest, it wasn't the fact that Conor Gallagher wasn't a bad player. It's the fact that Crystal Palace at the time hadn't done anything. I don't think any of us saw them beating Manchester City 2-0. So look, yeah, Conor Gallagher. He got a goal in the brace. It can happen. Christ, even Jamie Carragher scored a goal in this time, but yeah, look, if you had Conor Gallagher, and he's actually in your starting 11, well, fair play to you.
FPL vibes, you could go ahead. I know this one is for Robert Ducky.
Yeah, good evening, everyone. I just want to say, a few weeks I was on here and Robert, here we go. And Robert Ducky, we had a debate about whether Conor Gallagher could score through a couple fixtures here, and he was very dismissive. So I took his advice and I sold Conor Gallagher, and I've been out of some huge holes here. So I just wanted Mr. Ducky to.
I do believe. I never told anybody to sell him. Well, I did tell him not to get in.
No, he's here.
Oh no! I did say, like, what was the word, exact words I used? Like, do you really want Conor Gallagher?
I want a player who's scoring points, and this man is scoring points. So, I think you.
He had one good game.
No, he had about 10 good games, but
He has not had 10 good games.
He's been very good. But all jokes aside, Conor Gallagher has been very good for Crystal Palace. Vieira has them playing a lot more attacking and a lot more with the ball. I think the stats are now starting to reflect that. So in terms of the attacking options for Palace and with the fixtures that are coming up, I think it's about time Mr. Ducky apologizes first to the Trinidad FPL and then recommends Colour.
what price is Conor Gallagher now? What is he?
5.7 because other FPL players recognize that this player is scoring points and they bought him, and you know how price changes work, right? When a player is doing well,
would you have him over Mbeumo on the upcoming fixtures?
That's a good question. The thing is that I have Tony in my team, and I'm not doubling up on Brentford because I feel like it's a bit risky that the, not that they could have gotten figured out, but at the end of the day, Brentford is Brentford. So they need to, not what they've been showing in the last couple of weeks doesn't justify two attacking. So.
No, but if you didn't have Tony, would you have a Mbeumo over Gallagher?
Right now, probably yes. Right now, yeah. I would have Gallagher, yeah. Gallagher over Mbeumo.
No, you'd have Gallagher over Mbeumo.
Can I just make a point on Gallagher?
That's interesting.
Go ahead, Press.
A quick point. So, basically, if you go back to his stats over the season, it's very much correlated to Milivojevic not being on the pitch. So basically, what happens is whenever Milivojevic is on the pitch, he comes on, takes up all the set pieces. So if you look at the stats of Gallagher for the first 3 or 4 weeks, when he was basically getting all these assists, even getting in goal-scoring positions, it was when Milivojevic was out. Again, against City, he was out. So you're almost... And if you look at it when he was playing, it fell off a cliff. So number one, the first reservation that I have with Gallagher is if the match in which Milivojevic is playing, you pretty much have a central midfielder who's not on any set pieces. Number two, the issue is sometimes when they will play with two strikers, and Edouard is a good example, he doesn't get into the box as much. So this game against City is not a true reflection given the red card to Laporte. And even if you look at that second goal or the goal that Gallagher scored, he wasn't actually in the box. It was Zaha was trying to shoot and he was holding up the ball. They had no men at the back and then he just kind of ran in alone and scored. So what I'm trying to say is I don't think we should read too much into a game where City was down 10 men and Milivojevic wasn't playing. And personally, if I was to rank it, he still is third in my mind in terms of that price bracket between Mbeumo, Smith Rowe and Gallagher.
I mean, the City game, it was a freak result. And I think if they hadn't gone down to 10 men, that game would have finished very differently. But look, every dog has its day, and Gallagher had one, and he had it against City. You know, I think it's a fantastic point when you mentioned about Milivojevic. He takes all the set pieces when he's on, and he's coming back into the team. I think people who are now jumping onto Gallagher because of that, those points, that is ultimate points chasing. And they could easily end up being disappointed. I haven't brought him on my team. I'm more than happy to have
you're him. You're going to be apologising again in 3 weeks to our friend.
Well, if people are going to wait like 15 weeks and then he scores again, and they go, oh, you told me to get rid of Gallagher. Well, you had him for 15 weeks, you know.
But when does he become a must-have for you? When his EO reaches a certain point, when he scores a certain number of goals, there'll come a point where you just can't ignore him anymore.
Ash, you've been serious.
Like a Lingard.
I mean, like, what? I haven't said the minutes now. Is Milivojevic pretty much taking the majority of the minutes now? I mean, like, he's back now, isn't he? Pretty much.
But you made an interesting point, right? That the truth is, a lot of people who had Gallagher in their team, right, and against City, they probably would have benched him, and they've been very lucky to get him on as an auto sub. He's looked promising at times, but then there's other attackers in that Palace team as well who you could argue have more of a case. You know, you could argue as a viable FPL asset. I mean, one thing for certain, I've been genuinely shocked at how good Palace have been this season, better than I expected, more attacking than I expected, and, you know, fair play to Vieira and his
team. Well, yeah, they started off poorly, didn't they? They did start off very poorly. He slowly turned them around, and it'll be interesting to see if he can keep that going. But, yeah, look, he's turned them around. And that's just the wait and see. I mean, look, around that price point, there's a few people you can pick up. I'm not saying Conor Gallagher is a bad footballer. You've got to try and separate footballer from FPL asset.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a Chelsea fan. I'm over the moon that the club I support are producing guys like this. But I'm separating good footballer.
When you were raving about Kovacic about a week ago, and someone said to you that isn't Kovacic of a similar price range to Gallagher?
Before Kovacic got injured, if I needed him, I would have got Kovacic in. I think he was fantastic value.
All right, guys. So
he was, to be fair.
Yeah, Ash. Anyway. I think we out. We're running out of time, so we will continue this chat on your space tomorrow. So you can go ahead and tell everybody what time that would be.
Yeah, so I'm doing my space a day earlier than usual because of the Friday night game. So it's Thursday, 10:45 GMT. So Greenwich Mean Time. So yeah, you're all welcome. I've got a few topics that we're going to cover, and also freestyle questions as well. So yeah, feel free to join me then.
All right, thanks, Ash. Nima, you could go ahead and give some closing remarks.
You know, thanks for hosting, Javid. And as Kenwin said, let's definitely do this again. And I'm sure we'll have even more to ask him, because some of the insights we got today, they were great. And my favorite quote of the night for you was when you said, "And that's why we love Rubber Ducky," to Kenwin, in response to some of the comments he made. But nice to see you all. Good luck in the next game week. I'm actually flying, as I said, in like 4 hours. So I'm going to go to Barcelona. First time I'm leaving the UK in like 2 years. So I will probably not be online much, but I will photo spam the timeline. I will make sure I do that. See you guys very soon. It was a pleasure. And
take care, Nima.
Have a safe trip,
Thank
Nima.
You guys. Enjoy the rest of the show.